Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Today is Wednesday, first Wednesday of the month, and so we're going to be talking about animals in just a little while. But first, Linda Siegel is here with today's legislative update. Welcome, Linda.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So a lot has happened. Some of the governor's energy bills have passed. Is that correct?
Yes. A couple of very important ones have passed and actually been signed by the governor. One that would require that it's an incremental thing so that by 2020, 20% of the energy that all the electric and gas companies sell has to come from renewable sources. So that's a really positive thing.
What else is happening down at the legislature?
Well, actually, it's probably more about what is not happening, because here we are, we have 9.5 days left, and in actuality, there's only been about 6 bills that have gone to the governor to be signed, and 2 of them are those energy bills, and 1 is the feed bill, and 1 is the capital outlay bill, so things are not really moving up there. I mean, the governor did his State of the State speech. He said, you know, I want to see some DWI bills. I want to see my ethics reform, all in the first 30 days. Well, that certainly hasn't happened.
Do you think that we need to give a seminar on the perils of procrastination?
Well, and what's happening now, too, is that the House has had on the floor, on the House chamber, for several days, the cockfighting bill from the Senate and the medical marijuana bill from the Senate. And they've just been sitting there not being heard because the House says the Senate's not hearing their bills. And so we're in that. This happens every year. It's just happening a little later this year where we're kind of in deadlock. We're not going to hear your bills until you hear our bills. And that should loosen up any day now.
We did stuff like that when we were in the fourth grade. What about, there was a memorial that I thought would be worth talking about, which is a memorial to oppose the National Identification Card, the National Real ID Act. Is that going anywhere?
Yes, I think that has moved. I saw a hearing for that a couple days ago, so I think that's moving. I think there's some support for that. And the problem is, of course, that if we were to implement that federal law, it's going to cost the state of New Mexico millions and millions of dollars, aside from the fact that it's a really bad idea.
Not funded by the federal government, so that would come out of... Okay.
Absolutely not, federal dollars. The other thing that's really held up, the House has passed most of the ethics reform, limits on campaign contribution, gift limits to legislators, public financing of statewide and judicial offices. And all of those bills right now are sitting in the Senate Rules Committee, and they're not really moving, and we have 9.5 days left.
So what are the bills that you think, if you could, Linda Siegel, wave your magic wand and say, the following bills really need to be dealt with?
Well, I would want to see a lot of the ethics reform and the campaign reform bills passed. I would also like to see the domestic partnership bill for both gay and straight people pass. I'd like to see the medical marijuana bill pass, the cockfighting bill pass. I'd like to see more of the energy bills pass. So there's a lot of good legislation waiting for movement.
What about the health insurance, universal health coverage for New Mexicans?
Yeah, that's a bill, the Health Security Act, which has been pretty much jacked around. Of course, we have a study that's studying that as well as other alternatives, which is going to come out in June of this year. And that's really the reason that the legislature is just rescheduling that bill, moving it back and forth into committees. There's no way it's going to get through this session because many legislators want to see the results of that study.
Despite massive public outpouring of support.
despite it.
Ladies and gentlemen, what is democracy? Linda Siegel, what else is going on that you wanted to let us know about?
I think that's it for today. Hopefully we'll have some movement on Friday.
Well, Linda, we'll talk to you on Friday. Linda Siegel is with us with the Legislative Update Monday, Wednesday, and Friday here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about animals. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, this is our animal segment, and our regulars, Bill Hutchison from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and Darren Llewellyn, a veterinarian at Smith Veterinary Hospital, and also Dwayne Adams, Executive Director of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you all.
Thank you.
Bill and I were talking off the air one day, a few weeks ago, and we realized that, and Bill actually brought this up, which is that we always talk about the wonderful world of dogs and cats and cute little fluffy bunnies and isn't it all great and here's what you can do and, you know, really glossing over the problems, really glossing over the dark side of veterinary medicine, of shelter work, and there's a lot that our audience doesn't know about that kind of work. So we thought that we would bring this to our listeners today. And I wanted to ask each one of you, first of all, how did you get into the work you do? Dwayne Adams, you're the director of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. You've been in this work for a couple of decades.
About 25 years now. I'll try to give you a short version of how I got in this. I grew up, as most kids, you know, thinking what I wanted to be when I grew up, and what I wanted to be was a police officer, and started out at age 18 with the Arizona Humane Society and working with the animals there. Got to the point where I was old enough to join the police force and had to make a choice as to whether to go that route or not. I did go the route of being a police officer and served as a reserve police officer with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office for about 8 years, during which time I was really enjoying what I did working with the animals. At the same time, trying to feel where I wanted to fall, I ended up becoming an animal cruelty investigator for the animal shelter, and in that, I was able to fulfill both needs, to help the community be a police officer, yet do it by helping animals. And somewhere along the way, had the opportunity to have probably the premier police job I was offered, which was with the State Department of Public Safety, and just decided I couldn't leave the animal field. And never looked back, and ever since then, I've been just progressing in the animal world.
Darren, how did you become a veterinarian?
Well, as most veterinarians will say, they grew up as a kid wanting to be a vet. Really, my interest in veterinary medicine didn't spark until I was actually out of high school and into college. I grew up in a small town in the middle of a panhandle of Texas, and grew up on a farm. My dad's a farmer, and you know, of course, as a small child, I always wanted to be a farmer and drive tractors for the rest of my life. But I knew that that's a lot of work, and it's sometimes not rewarding. So,
whereas veterinary medicine isn't a lot of work.
Well, veterinary medicine is a lot of work, but you can dictate how well you do by how well you perform, and not have to rely on the weather so much. You know, a hailstorm comes through for a farmer, and he's wiped out for the season. And you know, it's always a gamble. As a veterinarian, you really don't have to worry too much, because you're indoors most of the time.
Right, right.
But really, I went to Texas A&M, which is a large university in Texas, and I was a biomedical science major, which is done through the veterinary school, and so I started taking a lot of veterinary level classes as an undergraduate, and that really sparked my interest, and I got more involved with the veterinary school there, and lucky for me, I was able to apply my first time after fulfilling my prerequisites, was accepted, and then continued my education in veterinary school. And then since graduating, it's been very rewarding and fulfilling.
Now, when you, growing up on the farm, did you have a lot of contact with animals that you draw on now as a veterinarian?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we had farm animals, of course, cows and pigs, and we had some sheep and things like that. But, you know, living or working on and around the farm, there are always stray animals that would, you know, meander by, and you could tell that they were hungry. And so we ended up having several, you know, barn cats and barn dogs that I guess you wouldn't consider them homeless, but they did like to, you know, wander around the acreage and act as if they were a wild dog, but they'd always show up for dinner time, you know? We had a lot of experience with those animals. And, you know, pretty much every house pet that we had was an animal that was abandoned on the farm. I can't tell you how many times we found boxes of puppies in the bar ditch, or we found a litter of kittens in our barn that the mama cat just ran in there to get out of the cold wind and ended up having her kittens in our barn. And so many of the animals we had around us were at some point homeless, and so that really kind of helped spark some interest and love for animals that later on carried me to become a veterinarian.
And you also, at an early age, presumably had to deal with or witness tough decisions about animals.
Oh, absolutely.
That's part of what we're going to talk about today.
Absolutely, yeah. And it still happens today, you know. I think my dad is really glad that I'm a veterinarian, because he gets free veterinary advice and care over the phone and whenever I do visit home for all of those animals. And you know, and I'll share a story later about one of these animals most recently and what had to be done. But there is a bad side to having, and it's really not a problem with the animals, but it's a problem with the people and how we're not being responsible caretakers of animals. And these animals end up, you know, either being stray or homeless, being sick, and there's no one to care for them. And you know, and that's our responsibility as a humane society and as a veterinary profession to make sure that these animals have a voice and make sure that these animals have a chance to carry on, and you know, in lieu of their prior situations.
Animals having a voice on KSFR. Bill Hutchison, how'd you get into the whole world of Animal Humane Society?
I had been working as a reporter for a local paper here in town and had met the previous director of the animal shelter. And after I left that paper and was working freelance for a couple of other publications who got hugely behind on paying their writers, I was desperate for money. And so I called up this director and I said, is there any chance you have any jobs available at the shelter? And I got hired part-time at the front desk and did that for a while, and then became a veterinary assistant in the clinic and did that for a while. And then when Dwayne took over, I got the chance to do this job, which is talk about the shelter, which it turns out is something that I really, really, really like to do.
Dwayne Adams, your first, well, not your first job, but this job of animal cruelty investigator, that sounds like tough stuff. What was your first, do you remember your first call?
Oh, I vividly remember my first call. I think it was being tossed into the abyss. My first ever call was a gentleman who had come home and found his dog had killed some of his chickens, and he literally lost it and did some really bad things to the dog, and started out with hitting the dog with a shovel, thinking it was dead. He tossed it in the garbage can. Then when the dog started crying and whimpering, he figured out it wasn't dead, so then he proceeded to attack the dog with an axe, and that didn't work, so then he filled the garbage can full of water in hopes of drowning it. When I got the call, and again, remember, this is my very first case ever, so I get the call, I roll out
this
there.
This is 25 years ago or so.
That's a good 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I rolled up onto the scene and then opened up the garbage can, so I'm hearing this little whimpering, and here's this little dog. There's two things about it. One is I remember vividly thinking, what the heck happened here? How could this be? And the other thing that crossed my mind is that animals, dogs, are so forgiving. You know, when I opened up that can, this was obviously a very traumatized animal, but the eyes looking back at me were simply, hi, thank you for opening the can, let me lick your face. There was no hostility towards people for all these terrible things that had happened to this poor dog. The dog did survive. I picked the dog up, took it back to our animal hospital, and it did survive. It had some very bad lacerations and lots of problems to contend with. But again, another thing, you know, working through that case, getting it to court, it took about 6 months before we finally got it to court, and I was able to see the gentleman in court who had done this.
Gentleman being a euphemism.
Yeah. Well, I can't say what I was thinking on the air, but I think it was one of those seven words. I remember thinking to myself, this, how remarkable are animals that if this dog was to see this person, he would instantly go right back to him and just want nothing but love and affection from this person who'd done these horrible things to him.
Now, was the person prosecuted?
Oh, yes.
And what happened?
Well, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about is, you know, people are often say, what can we do to make better laws? And anytime somebody hears about a terrible story like that, they think, well, we need better laws. You know, at the time that happened, again, that's 20 years ago, the animal cruelty was a misdemeanor. And the fact was, what happened to the gentleman, he was given 6 months probation. So basically nothing. He got a slap on the hand, said, you know, don't own any animals for the next 6 months, check in with your probation officer, and everything's going to be fine. You know, that bothered me. And that's when I started thinking, like everyone else, oh my gosh, we need better laws. Well, past 15 years, I was a lobbyist with the state of Arizona and passed many of the animal cruelty laws there. I started figuring out that it didn't matter what laws we passed if we didn't have enforcement and we didn't have follow-through from the prosecuting system. You know, the fact was the judge could have sentenced this man to 6 months in county jail, could have given him a $2,500 fine, could have done a lot of things that he should have done, could have gotten the man mandatory psychiatric counseling so that, I mean, obviously he lost it. He lost control of what he was doing. You know, had this been a child, had this been his wife, you know, we all know the stories of what happens when people lose it, when they can't control their emotions. And, you know, my fear was this man did have a wife and children. What's going to happen when he comes home and finds the kids had done something wrong? He needed help. He didn't get that help. The system, in my opinion, let him down. Now, that was 20 years ago, and things have changed a lot. I think we still have a long ways to go, but I guess my point is I don't like when people always accuse, you know, criticize the laws and say we need better laws. Well, we need better understanding. We need better laws. We need people to enforce those laws. We need people to take them serious, and we need people to understand what their true problem is that there's some people out there who need help.
Now, in Arizona, stronger laws were passed, partially in thanks to you. What about enforcement? I mean, was that, where did that, did that piece actually, and the judiciary, I mean, are they prosecuting people with their new laws?
Again, that's where I say there's still a long ways to go. Yes, things are definitely a lot better. We started things like a task force with the prosecutor, connecting the prosecutors with the police agencies, with the investigators, so that when something like this happens, there's a system where it's monitored as it goes through the process, and so that nothing slips through the cracks. You know, is it foolproof? Is it 100%? No, it's still got a lot of work to do. But more and more, and the more the education of groups, like here in New Mexico, we have the APNM, Animal Protection New Mexico, that really works hard to track these cases and talk to the judges and the prosecutors to make sure that they know how serious this problem is. It's not that a person did something horrible to a dog. It's only a dog. Well, no, it's a life form. It's, you know, this time it's the dog. Next time it's the child. Then it's the wife. You know, you got to take these things serious. You know, all of the serial killers, when they went back and started profiling them, found out that they all started out with animal abuse early on. Were those animal abuse cases notated? Possibly, but I guarantee you, at the time they probably were overlooked. And said, well, this child or this person has a propensity to do bad things to animals. Well, it's not a far stretch before it stretches over to humans.
Bill Hutchison, that's something that you've really been observing.
Dwayne and I talked a lot about this last year, and we talked about it on the air because Smith, I believe, got the dog I'm about to talk about. Mm-hmm. There was the case last year of the man who beat his dog almost to death with a frying pan. Mm-hmm. Because it was his girlfriend's dog, rather, because it had pooped on the floor.
Right.
And that dog was taken to Smith and had to be later euthanized because of the extent of its injuries. And as the case progressed, there was an expert witness who came on for the defense that said, you need to let this guy off. First of all, he's not going to present a danger to humans. And this expert witness, one of the core parts of his testimony was that there's no link between domestic violence and animal abuse. And that there was a quick letter fired off from HSUS to Judge Pfeffer, who was the
HSUS
Humane Society of the United States. I apologize to Judge Pfeffer, the presiding judge in that case, citing the fact that since 1950 there have been something like over 50 legitimate scientific studies linking domestic violence and animal abuse. And, you know, what Duane's saying is, honestly, this is one of the few things that sometimes leaves me speechless, because I don't know how sometimes law enforcement officials, whether they're judges or police officers or even prosecuting attorneys, can hear the narrative of cases like this and not take it seriously enough to think, this is a tremendous problem. This is not something that 6 months probation is going to solve. And, you know, obviously it's usually part of a cycle, and without some kind of psychiatric treatment, or at the very least some kind of penal response, I don't see that there's much hope of... things are changing, but it's...
Can I jump in here for a second,
yeah, please.
Bill? Because without some type of intervention, things aren't going to get better. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to work on both sides, to go into homes where I'm there to as an animal protection person, to try to see what's going on with the animals, and turn around and see the children who are, you know, have the same symptoms as the dog. You know, and vice versa. There's
meaning
a police officer...
anxiety.
Well, meaning bruises, meaning, you know... You see holes in the walls, you see scared children, you see a scared dog, you see everybody sitting there worried about what dad or mom is going to do when they find out that somebody's there at the house.
Now, dad or mom, oh, I see, when a law enforcement person comes to the house.
Yeah, and being there as a law enforcement officer, you know, I'm there because of some type of domestic violence situation, so I'm trying to deal with the family, and I turn around and I look and here's the dog. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, you've got all the symptoms as well. Anybody who has served in law enforcement or as an animal protection officer will tell you, without having to do all the studies, there is a link. You know, when a person starts out taking their anger, their frustrations out on another living creature, it doesn't matter whether it's a human or an animal.
You've seen this firsthand, Bill Hutchison, in your work at the animal shelter.
We've had, I think probably all three of us have seen it firsthand. We run across a lot of cases of animal abuse. One of the things, I was thinking about this yesterday, Mary Charlotte and I had talked yesterday about some of the things that the shelter is planning on doing to raise awareness about some of these issues, and we talked about tethering, which is, you know, keeping an animal on a chain in a yard for 24 hours a day. One of the things, first things I saw when I came to work at the animal shelter was an embedded chain in the neck of a dog, which for the first time I saw it, I thought, God, I hope I never see this again. And the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth, et cetera, time I saw it, you don't ever get used to it, but you do see it. And it's a tremendous thing. I mean, keeping an...
I know exactly what you're talking about, Bill, and I'm sure Darren has seen many things like that. It's one of those things that you get, it comes in, you're thinking to yourself, how in the world can somebody not have noticed that this puppy has grown and the collar has not been let loose? I mean, this is horrible. And there's times when you have to surgically remove these collars from the neck. I mean, doctor...
Yeah, and I can't tell you how many cases of that I've actually seen. I mean, I don't have enough fingers to count them, you know, and that's unfortunate. I've only been practicing medicine for 7 years now. And it can be absolutely deplorable. I've seen wounds of grown-in collars so terribly infected, the dog's nearly choking to death, the wound is infested with insect larvae, You see this animal and it's brought into you, and it's the actual owners that are bringing the animal into you. And at that point, you know, I basically, and this may be different for you guys, but my biggest concern is the animal, and how am I going to protect and save this animal? And of course, you know, oftentimes the owners may not have money to take care of this animal, and at that point, you know, oftentimes I end up having to act almost as a humane society and saying, if you surrender this animal to me, I will find it a good home, but I'm going to take care of it. And when that happens, oftentimes I also have to make a report to the local humane society or animal protection division of the police department and file a report. And the really sad thing for me as a veterinarian is that I get to see the horrors of what's brought into me. But very rarely do I get to see the resolution on the other end, because once I file that report, it's in the hands of law enforcement.
Do you have the power to say that I'm going to have the animal taken away from its owner?
I really don't. That is really the power of law enforcement. And what happens in those cases is that if I suspect a case of animal cruelty or neglect, then it's my responsibility to file a report to the authorities. It's the authorities that say, this animal is being taken away from you, and these are the punitive damages that are going to occur because of what you've done to this animal. I'm really there as a provider for the animal, and that's taking responsibility to making sure that this animal is cared for, as far as treating wounds or whatever. My very first case, and I wasn't even a veterinarian yet. I was actually volunteering in a veterinary hospital. This was while I was in college, but it was a dog that was brought in that was beat by a boy with a stick that had a nail through it. The dog had multiple puncture wounds to his chest and was dying because he had a pneumothorax. And this is horrible to see this dog gasping for air on the table, trying to live. And it's an obviously cared for animal because his coat was nice and shiny, and it wasn't matted. It didn't have a lot of sticks and brush, stuck in it. But it was a good Samaritan that brought this dog in. They found the dog lying there, gasping for air, and they brought it in to be cared for. And nobody knows who the child was. It was obvious what had happened to the dog.
How do you know it was a child?
Well, I don't know if it was a child, but it was secondhand from the Good Samaritan. Said they saw some boys in the neighborhood carrying a stick with a nail in it around, and nothing ever became of it. And so there are so.
And the dog died.
No, we saved the dog. The dog lived. We mended the wounds. We took care of the pneumothorax, and the dog made it. It was several weeks in the hospital, but the dog made it.
Wow.
And then it was turned over to the Humane Society, where it found a good home. And there are a lot of cases, and I guess you guys may attest to this too, but there are a lot of cases where the only victim is the animal, and nothing is done about it.
Well, the only victim is the animal, but then you wonder, as the three of you are speaking, the question that comes to my mind is what are the lives of these people like that do this to animals? I mean, the level of awareness, half of the listeners to this program are probably, studying yoga and meditation and trying to increase their awareness, and we observe in ourselves things that we weren't aware of before we become sensitized to. But the awareness of a loving creature, it's not even just a bug. It's a domestic pet that loves you and that expresses love in a way that's palpable. The ability to be, what's going on? What are these people's lives like? I suppose it's, as you've mentioned, it's similar to people who would abuse children, but what's going on?
I was thinking about that while Darren was talking about the victims being the animals. I do think a lot of the time the victims are the people. The studies show, and if you talk to people who abuse animals or kids, a lot of them come from histories of abuse themselves. When I went on along with our first hoarding case, when I first started at the animal shelter, I got really fascinated by animal hoarding because.
Now, what is animal hoarding?
Animal hoarding is when somebody. The most basic definition, correct me if I'm wrong, is somebody who's taking care of more animals, who has more animals than they can take care of.
Well, it's a compulsive disorder to hoarding, and we find that people who hoard things, they can hoard animals as well. It's often associated with cats, and I think there's even a little figurine thing of a cat lady.
The crazy cat lady.
But it's not necessarily restricted to cats, and I've been on hundreds of hoarding cases, and I'm always amazed to see what their disorder is aside from cats. They'll have cats or
500
dogs.
Plastic bags.
Exactly.
They don't throw old Coke bottles,
away.
Newspapers.
Yeah. We were just on a case about 6 months ago here in Santa Fe with a trailer, a mobile home that, the officers going in to get the cats out, they literally could not figure out how to get in the mobile home. It was so much debris, I would call it garbage, to this person, it was her possessions, you know, that they couldn't even get in the house. It was terrible. But
the first case I went on, there were pockets all the way up the driveway. I mean, you could start smelling the ammonia from the urine at the bottom of the driveway, but there were pockets of collections, baby food jars, piles of metal, old industrial microwaves, barber chairs, camper shells. And then we got inside, and all these animals were in these really incredibly deplorable conditions, and it was really a difficult day, I think, for my very first hoarding case. I really had no idea that this was happening in the world, and I was shocked to find out that it was. But what I immediately started thinking about after we got the animals back to the shelter and had taken care of as many as we could have was this woman, that what was going on in her life, what had led her to this point. And you know, I don't know what the fix to that is, but I think it's important for us to remember as we talk about these animal welfare issues that these all come from people who come from somewhere. I mean, we desperately need to help the animals that are in these conditions, but from what I understand, hoarders have one of the highest rates of recidivism of any kind of compulsion like that, that as soon as you clean out a hoarder's house and they go through the court process or the social services process, they either move somewhere else and start collecting again, or they don't move somewhere else and start collecting again. Oh,
absolutely. I was leaving Arizona. I was doing one hoarder for the third time.
Well, that brings up the question of if these people are, you know, sick. I mean, they have actual psychological, psychiatric problems. You know, what can help? I mean, a lot of psychiatry, a lot of therapy doesn't work.
Yeah, and what's being done to help these people too is there's very rarely is there court mandated psychiatric counseling for some of these cases. And so, you know, sometimes if they're not getting help on their own, we might have to be telling them to get the help that they need.
But I mean, does that help work? I find myself a little skeptical.
You take like with any disorder, it will work with some people, and some people you have to continue to look for the right help to get them. But that's one of the things that's changed in the 20-some years I've been involved in animal welfare. In the beginning, we considered animal hoarders animal cruelty, and you know, and we looked at it that way. When somebody was found guilty, you try to get them, you know, some type of a system with a fine or jail time. You know, and quickly started realizing, wait a minute, there's something else at play here. And that's where working with psychiatrists, we're able to figure out that this is a hoarding situation, this is a behavior disorder, and start getting them, instead of, you know, looking at mandatory sentencing guidelines, instead of getting the person sent to jail, which isn't going to help them, getting them sent to psychiatric counseling, which hopefully will. And, you know, over the years with the hundreds of hoarding cases I've had, you know, many of them all of them got sentenced to psychiatric help. You know, there is a handful of them, and with one, I had to go back on the third time. But I like to think that some of those people did find the help they needed and have moved on and are productive members of society now.
There's another issue that I know Bill wanted to talk about, which is backyard breeding.
Yeah, it's funny. I got a call from someone in Albuquerque, from a newspaper in Albuquerque, their classified department. And I didn't know this, but the Albuquerque Journal has a rule that they won't list your puppies for sale unless you can give them your breeding permit number or that litter permit number. And in Santa Fe, there are I don't know that there are any numbers on it, but there are so many backyard breeders. And a backyard breeding means you've got somebody who has a Chihuahua, or maybe has two Chihuahuas, and they start breeding them to sell the puppies and make a little extra money on the side.
Because it's a purebred dog and people want purebred dogs.
Yeah, but this isn't like selling apples off your apple tree. I mean, a lot of these backyard breeders are breeding animals who have some really chronic health problems. I mean, even legitimate breeders will concede. There was a really interesting article in the New York Times Magazine 2 or 3 weeks ago where a lot of legit AKC breeders talk about some of the difficulties they have in breeding purebred dogs now because of the gene pool problems, etc. But backyard breeders in Santa Fe, where we have such a tremendous overpopulation problem already, are doing such a disservice to the animals of this community. And the sad fact is, most of them aren't Chihuahuas. If you look in the paper or on signs around town or on things stapled up on telephone poles, you'll see how many of them are purebred pit bulls that people are selling. And as we've talked about before, and you know, part of what we had tried to, part of what the shelter tried to address with the pit stop day we did a few weeks back was the fact that with as many unwanted animals as there are in Santa Fe already, and with as many problems as we have with dogs who don't have proper upbringings, these backyard breeders are exacerbating an already pretty gruesome problem.
And I agree. I can't tell you how many. And Bill's exactly right. A lot of backyard breeders, excuse me, are breeding chronic diseases into these animals. And I can't tell you how many pit bulls and chihuahuas and things like that that come through our doors and say, "Well, I got it from somebody that was selling it in the parking lot at Walmart, or I got it on the side of the road." And these dogs have hip dysplasia. These dogs have other chronic health issues that a responsible breeder of purebred dogs, they try to get these out of their gene pool and
now there are
instead
even,
of propagating
even
it.
Even with professional breeders, you've got these problems.
Absolutely. And a professional breeder, it's their responsibility, and what they want to do is to make sure that they're selling healthy dogs that are representative of the lineage of their dogs that they have. And oftentimes, you know, these dogs are going to homes where the new prospective owners have been interviewed several times, have been to and from the breeding facility several times, because really it's not a responsible breeder just doesn't sell their dog to any Tom, Dick, or Harry that comes up and wants a dog for $100. They're wanting to make sure that these dogs are going to responsible people that are going to, you know, really protect the lineage of that purebred dog. Backyard breeders, you know, like Bill said, oftentimes are in it for a quick buck, and they'll sell a dog to anyone, and they don't really know what kind of home that dog is going to be going into. Is that dog going to be going into an abusive home and it's going to have a poor quality of life? They don't care. They're just in it for the quick buck. Whereas a responsible breeder really takes interest in where these puppies or kittens, for that matter, are going. And
you know,
we don't see that a lot of times.
One of the subtexts in all of this is poverty and lack of education.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big thing too, lack of education, and not nearly, not, you know, it's more of ignorance, a lack of common sense in a lot of cases. I'm going to bring up a little story. A little story from, I guess this was 2 to 3 years ago, and at Smith Veterinary Hospital, we had a Doberman puppy that came in that the owner had wanted its ears cropped, which is a practice that's still accepted by most of the breeders, you know, and show associations of certain breeds of dogs, Dobermans being one of them. This Doberman puppy had its ears cut off with a pair of scissors, and when they couldn't get the bleeding to stop, they doused the dog's head in gasoline. Fortunately for the puppy, he made it, and it took a lot of work, but he had gone through several of the hospitals here in Santa Fe. This was a local case, and he had been in Smith, he had been to some of the other veterinarians in town, but the puppy made it, and you know, I'm not sure what happened, but I do believe that person got prosecuted to almost the full extent that he could be. But it's just ignorance. Why, you know, you wanted your dog's ears to be cropped because it made it look meaner, or it's part of the breed. But to be a responsible pet owner, they could have taken that dog. There aren't, I don't think, any veterinarians here in Santa Fe that do ear croppings anymore. There may be one, I'm not sure. But if you look around, there are still veterinarians that will do it the proper way and make sure that it's done. You know, that's a debate all in and of itself, is the ear and tail cropping situation. But for the time being, it's still an accepted practice for certain breeds of dogs. And to have, you know, you need to be responsible and educated enough to have it done the correct way instead of trying to do it yourself.
Well, that's surgery.
Exactly.
I mean, you might as well give yourself an appendectomy.
Exactly. It's cosmetic surgery. And for this to happen to a dog, it's deplorable. And it's just pure ignorance on the on the owner's part why this happened.
Something I've been thinking a lot about as I've been having various conversations at the shelter is that you don't know until you know. You know, my last 4 years at the shelter, how I behaved toward my animals is so much different than how it was when I started. And when I started, I thought I was a pretty good pet owner. Dwayne and I were talking last week about growing up. And you know, when I was a kid, one of my dogs killed a bunch of our neighbor's chickens. So my dad shot the dog in the head. And for my dad, that was what you did. I mean, you can't have a chicken killer. You gotta shoot the dog in the head if it kills chickens. And they stayed outside. And it's hard because you can educate people, but you can't make them take that education. I mean, a lot of it is your own realizations. A lot of it is how you, as a person, learn these things. And you learn a lot by, a lot of what I learned was by watching a lot of my colleagues at the shelter, how they treated their animals and what their expectations were for our adopters. And I think sometimes their expectations for our adopters were too high, because I think we have to be very realistic about where people are at. But the education and the poverty, while it's really contributive, there's not a quick fix. It's not like we can run everybody through a class that says, all right, here's how you can be a decent person to humans and other animals. Because it's really much more deep-seated than that. It's even though I thought I was much more an enlightened, so to speak, animal owner than my dad was, it wasn't until I came to the shelter and had people who were much more conscious of how they treated their animals than I was, did I realize that there were a lot of things, a lot of ways that I treated my animals
like
that I was embarrassed about.
What have you done differently now that you've been working at the animal shelter?
One of the things that I was just thinking about, that I went away for the weekend and you know, left my dogs with my housemate, and he also works at the shelter, so they were in excellent hands. But you know, I lived out of town for a long time and would sometimes spend the night in Santa Fe with my girlfriend at the time, and would leave my dogs at home overnight. They, you know, I wouldn't go home after work. They'd be there, say, sometimes for 24, 25, 26 hours in a row when I wasn't there to let them out. And I'd feel kind of bad. I'd think, I gotta let them out. They probably really have to pee. And now I think back to that, and that is such a painful thing for me to remember, because I think now about how they are when I get home after being gone for 8 hours. And you know, I have had this thing running in my mind since Dwayne said it, but when you know, he talked about opening the can and seeing that dog with those forgiving eyes. Dogs will forgive you for anything, which in its own way is kind of terrible, because then you are the one that ends up kind of that carries that recognizes, I did something that is really pretty terrible. I mean, there are a lot worse things than leaving your dog confined to a house for 24 plus hours. But that's a pretty terrible way to treat a really social animal. Dogs are one of the most social animals that I
Right.
think are part of our lives. I mean, in a way that's much different than cats. Cats, of course, are social animals, but dogs need that interaction. Dogs really psychologically thrive on that human interaction. And that's one of those things that, looking back now, I just can't believe at the time that I didn't realize what a problem I think that really was.
Leaving dogs inside is one thing, and then leaving them outside is another. The reason I own my little dog, Honey, is because my neighbors had four dogs, including Honey, and the other three were big winter dogs with big, thick coats, and they let them outside. And Honey was a little short-haired Jack Russell Terrier who was a year old, and she was freezing. This was in the dead of winter, and she would she dug a nice little hole under the fence, came into my house, and got warm. And she basically moved in. I thought she was going to have her then she got knocked up by a dog down the street because they hadn't had her spayed. I thought she was going to have her puppies on my bed because that's where she spent a lot of her time. And, you know, I think people, I mean, there are some dogs where you really can leave them outside for periods of time because they're bred, like huskies, to be in Alaska or the South Pole or whatever. But little short-haired dogs, it's just a form of cruelty.
The inside-outside thing, I think, I mean, a lot of what I'm talking about, I think, is the neglect. I mean, there are a lot of winter breeds who can do just fine spending the bulk of their time outside, but they still need that attention and interaction and stimulation and enrichment. And if they don't have that, then they'll suffer, much the same way a person who doesn't have any kind of stimulation or enrichment or any kind of interaction will suffer. So, yeah, a dog that can stay outside can probably live a pretty good life if it's outside, you know,
if
a certain amount
kind of
time.
Fur, yeah.
But it also desperately needs that interaction with people and other animals.
Toward the beginning of the show, Darren, you said that there was a story from your dad from the farm in Texas that you wanted to tell.
The farm dogs. This is a, you know, kind of an endearing story, but this dog, particular dog, has it kind of adopted a corner part of our farm. There's a little house there that we have tenants, and the dog just kind of adopted that little area. He'd never went indoors. He'd always hang out around the barn and around that corner lot. And so my dad started feeding him. It was a little lab pit bull mix, and so, you know, basically my dad adopted him as the quote unquote farm dog that would hang around and you know, just kind of meander around for the day and then come in at dinner time. My dad found several homes for this dog in the area, would even carry the dog to their new prospective owner, where I guess these owners would just leave the dog out to roam around and do whatnot. The dog would come back to that corner piece of our farm and had done this three different times. And so he pretty much said, this is where I want to be. This is where I'm going to stay. This is where I'm getting fed. You know, of course, with a dog that roams around and things like that, and I don't blame my father for this, but, you know, you can't always check on him and see what's going on. And so earlier this year, my father calls and says, well, I think there's something wrong with the dog because he's limping now. And I was going to be in the area the next couple of weeks. I said, all right, well, Dad, you should try to take him in to the vet if you can. Of course, the dog runs away whenever you try to catch him or anything like that. But I ended up being able to look at the dog. And this dog, the reason he was limping, had a congenital mange, basically. It's called demodectic mange. It's a type of mite that buries into the hair follicle, and usually these mites are transferred from mother to pup in utero. So basically they're born with these mites living in their skin. This dog had it so bad in all four of its feet that the feet were so inflamed and infected that the dog would leave a puddle of pus with each footstep. And at that point I told my father, I said, Dad,
this is a breakfast show, Darren.
Well, I'm sorry, but I told my father, said he needs a lot of work and a lot of care. And the sad thing is that this dog was not a treatable dog. You know, you couldn't get close enough to him to give him his medications that he needed. You couldn't catch him to take him to the vet to get the proper medicated dips and things like that. And it would have taken a long time for a fairly big dog like this to recover from something like this. And so I told my father, you know, the best thing for this guy is to be put to sleep. And what the whole meaning of the story is that as a veterinarian, that is sometimes the hardest decision that I ever have to make, is to say that this dog's quality of life is so deplorable that he would be better off going to the next life than remaining in this one. And I think that's a decision that SPCA, you know, nationwide, you know, these decisions that we have to make on a daily basis can really kind of tear at your soul sometimes. And but you know, it's at the same thing, and we were having this conversation before the show started, but humane euthanasia, and there are many people on either side of the spectrum as far as how they feel about humane euthanasia. But I, as a veterinarian, I really feel that it's the last best gift that we can give some of these animals, because we can prevent them from suffering. Because suffering oftentimes is the worst.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Darren Llewellyn is a veterinarian at Smith Veterinary Hospital. Dwayne Adams is the executive director of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Bill Hutchison is the communications manager at that same institution. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a very enlightening conversation.
Thanks for having me.
And we hope to do it again sometime. The animal segment is the first Wednesday of every month here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We are on the web at ksfr.org. I hear a sound.
I was just going to say how much I look forward to it every month.
And Dal Dierman loves the animal segment because he loves little puppies and kittens so very much. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Dal for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow right here on KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. We're here Monday through Friday on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Hasta la vista.